The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi. Welcome to That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today is all about homeownership, with its quirky, frustrating day-to-day challenges and charms. First, I'll be reading from the book My Nest Isn't Empty, It Just Has More Closet Space, by Lisa Scottolini, with Francesca Scottolini Saratella, published in 2010. The back cover of the book says, quote, Lisa Scottolini is the New York Times best-selling and Edgar Award-winning author of 17 novels and president of Mystery Writers of America. She also writes a weekly column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. There are 26 million copies of her books in print in the United States, and she has been published in 30 countries. She lives in Pennsylvania with too many pets, some of whom are cranky that they didn't make the cover of this book. End quote. Francesca Scottolini Saratella is Lisa's daughter. Also, Lisa refers to her mother as Mother Mary and her two ex-husbands as Thing One and Thing Two. First, I'll read her story titled Junk in the Trunk. If Freud wanted to know what women want, he could have asked. If he'd asked me, I would have answered another kitchen cabinet. And I just got one. Here's how it happened. It was about 10 years ago that I remodeled my kitchen, adding white cabinets and a trash compactor. To tell the truth, I don't remember wanting a trash compactor, and I think it was Thing Two who wanted a trash compactor, but I blamed enough on him, so let's just say I wanted a trash compactor. At the time, my kitchen contractor said, I'll install this trash compactor for you, but I bet you'll never use it. I'm sure I'll use it, I said, and I probably added, plus it will give me something to blame on somebody down the line. In any event, the trash compactor got installed, and it came with two free bags, which I promptly lost. 10 years and one divorce later, it turns out that the contractor was right. I should have married the contractor. Anyway, I never used the trash compactor, not once. I even forgot it was there until 3 months ago, when it began to emit a mysterious and foul odor. I searched the thing and could find no reason for it to be smelly, but I washed it inside and out anyway. Still, the smell got worse and worse until it was so bad I could barely eat in the kitchen. Then one day, the electrician came over to fix a light, and he said, "Smells like something died in there." Bingo! The electrician showed me that you could slide out the compactor, which I hadn't realized, and when we did, we found behind it an aromatic gray mound that used to be a mouse. Eek! The electrician threw the dead mouse away, and I cleaned the trash compactor all over again, but it still stunk worse than my second marriage, which I didn't even think was possible. So I threw the trash compactor away too, which left an oddly empty space on my kitchen island, a dark square among the white cabinets, like a missing front tooth. I called the kitchen contractor, whose phone number I still had from 10 years ago. As soon as he heard my voice, he said, "Told you," and came right over. Last week, he installed a new cabinet, including a drawer, then asked, "What are you going to use it for?" "I'm not sure yet," I told him, excited by the possibilities. It was almost too much to hope for. A nice empty cabinet and a whole extra drawer. After he had gone, I pulled up a stool and contemplated my course of action. The decision required me to consider the problem areas of my kitchen cabinets, which are many. My pot and pan cabinet is a mess because I hate to stack pots and pans in their proper concentric circles. I just pile them up anyway, plain Jenga, only with Farberware. Also, I can never figure out how to store pot lids, so I stick them in upside down, setting them wobbling on handles like the worst tops ever. Every time I open the cabinet door, they come sliding out like a stainless steel avalanche. I also have a cabinet containing Rubbermaid and Tupperware, but it's all mixed up, so that the Rubbermaid lids are with the Tupperware containers and the Rubbermaid containers are with the Tupperware lids, making the whole thing feel vaguely illicit. Then I have a cabinet of kitchen appliances I have never used once in my life but feel compelled to keep close at hand, namely a juicer, a waffle iron, and a salad shooter. You never know when you'll have to shoot a salad. My kitchen drawers are equally problematic. I have one drawer for silverware and four others for junk, 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 and junk. All the junk drawers contain the same junk, just more of it, namely pins that don't work, pencils that have no points, extra buttons that go to clothes I've never seen, rubber bands I got free but can't part with, menus for restaurants I don't order from, and pennies. In other words, it's all essential. I think I know what to put in that empty cabinet. Trash compactor bags. The next story is titled Killer Apps. Not only are my appliances breaking down, they're conspiring against me. Or at least, though they claim to make my life easier, they really make it harder. Observe. I produce only 7 dirty dishes a day, namely 1 mug, morning coffee, 3 plates, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 3 glasses, daily allotment of 2 Diet Cokes before forced by guilt to segue to tap water, and 56 spoons for eating Häagen-Dazs out of the container. I could wash my dishes in 10 minutes, but I don't, because I have a beautiful dishwasher, now only 1 year old. I load it up every night and forget about the dirty dishes, only to unload them the next morning, even dirtier. This goes on for a month. I'm convinced it's my imagination, but my glasses and dishes keep looking worse than when I put them in. I rack my brain, but can't figure it out. So I go through the good girl checklist. Dishes rinsed off first? Check. Placed in rack properly? Check. Living a good and honest life? Check. Yet my dishes remain filthy. I give up and call the appliance guy. He examines the dishwasher, then asks, "Do you use a drying agent?" "A what?" "Evidently not." He points to a mysterious hole in the dishwasher door. "That's what this is for. You put the drying agent in here. It will prevent the buildup from the water." "Now," they tell me, "why didn't I know about drying agents?" "It's in the owner's manual. Did you read it?" "Did it have a car chase?" He doesn't answer. Then, no. He adds, "You can buy a drying agent in any grocery store, and you should also pick up a dishwasher cleaning agent." I try to follow. My dishwasher needs to be cleaned. Sure. But isn't it supposed to wash things?
Yes.
So, why doesn't it just wash itself? He gathers my question is rhetorical, which it isn't, and I walk him to the door, cranky. I have to buy dishwashing powder, a drying agent, and a dishwashing washing agent, all to clean 7 dishes? What does the dishwasher do to earn its keep, if you ask me? Somebody's slacking, and his name rhymes with KitchenAid. My clothes dryer isn't pulling its weight either. For the past year, I have to put it through 2 cycles to dry anything. And if you think I use only a few dishes, I won't even tell you how often I wash my sheets. Generally, I wait for the dogs to complain. Anyway, I call the appliance guy, and he says the clothes dryer is fine, but I need to clean the outtake hose because of the buildup. Buildup again? What buildup? There's no water there. No, but there's humid air. Air can build up? I ask him, incredulous. Relent. Check the owner's manual. You'll see. Now I hate the owner's manual more than I hate the buildup. And don't even get me started on lighting timers. In a fit of temporary insanity, I had timers installed on the lights at my front door, back door, and garage. The electrician stuck these very tasteful white things into my light switches. And they'd be great if they worked, but they don't. The second day on the job, they joined the appliance conspiracy. So I can never guess what time they'll go on or off. Now, the front lights go on at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and go off at nightfall, like accomplices to all burglars in the tri-state area. Plus, the garage light goes on at 2 in the morning, just in time to wake me and the dogs up so we can all bark for the next hour when we fall into an exhausted sleep. I would turn the lights on and off manually, but the fancy timer switchers won't let me do that. They're the control freaks of the electrical world. I can't even claw them out of the switch plate, nor do they respond to profanity and other forms of verbal abuse. Now, the only thing building up is my blood pressure. And finally, from Lisa, a mystery solved in the story, Angie, the KitchenAid. This is a world in which the squeaky wheel gets the grease, but I'm wondering if we should change that. Tell you what happened. It was a typical afternoon, Shay Scottolini, and I was working in my kitchen office, which is a euphemism for the computer nearest the refrigerator, my favorite place to work for obvious reasons. Anyway, the kitchen was quiet except for the thrumming of the dishwasher, which was running for the second time that day because I was trying to get the glasses clean, if you recall. I've been having dishwasher drama, and it turns out that all the rinsing agents in the world have failed me. It was making me crazy, a mystery I couldn't solve. My glasses were cloudy enough to be a weather report. To stay on point, I was working happily, surrounded by the dogs. Little Tony sat in my lap because he always begs to come up. Ruby, the crazy corgi, was at my feet since she usually curls up there. Penny, my younger golden retriever, was sitting beside me, pawing to be petted, which is her habit. Only Angie, my other older golden, was on her own, lying near the dishwasher, probably because it was warm. Angie is soft, fluffy, and plump, with fur the toasty hue of vanilla wafers, and all she was doing was watching me, resting her head on her paws, her brown eyes dark as bittersweet chocolate in a mask of gray with age. She didn't paw, scratch, or whine. She asked for nothing. I caught her eye, and she flopped her tail once, letting it thwap on the hardwood floor, because all it takes to make Angie happy is to look in her direction. And because she never asks for anything, she doesn't get very much. She's 12 years old, and she comes on our daily walks when she's up for it, but she doesn't get the attention the pushy ones do. Angie isn't a squeaky wheel. But that day, seeing her by herself, I finally focused on her and realized that I had been neglecting her. Just because she didn't ask for attention didn't mean she didn't deserve it or need it. She's a great old dog, even more precious because she won't be around forever. So I lifted little Tony from my lap, stepped over Ruby, ignored Penny, and went over to Angie. I sat down on the floor beside her, gave her a big kiss, and scratched behind her ear while she drifted off into a noisy slumber. And of course I began to relax too, in a deep, centered way, and I realized that she was the gift you get from a dog like Angie. Because she's at peace with herself, she makes you at peace with yourself. It made me understand that I'm rarely spending time doing something as simple as petting a sleeping dog, and that I'm often, too often, running in all directions, responding to the ring of cell phones, the beep of incoming mail, and the latest text in my BlackBerry. Angie made me take a break. I enjoyed the moment, letting my gaze wander over the things I see every day in the kitchen, like the baby photographs of daughter Francesca, the bamboo plant in the windowsill, and a crumpled tube of toothpaste near the sink. I brush my teeth 3 times a day like a good girl, and about 2 months ago, I started keeping a toothbrush and toothpaste downstairs because I got too lazy to keep running upstairs. Then, in a blink, it struck me. I'd been brushing my teeth in the kitchen sink, and that residual toothpaste must have been going down the drain, which flowed to the same pipe that feeds water to the dishwasher. In other words, there's nothing wrong with my KitchenAid. There's something wrong with me. If I stop brushing my teeth in the kitchen sink, the clouds should clear from my glassware. Mystery solved. And all because I finally took the time to think, thanks to a sweet old golden retriever, Angie. Now let's join Dave Barry as he tries to redecorate his house for under $650,000 from his book, Homes and Other Black Holes, published in 1988. The best way to get decorating ideas is to buy several glossy interior design publications, such as Architectural Digest, the international magazine of homes much nicer than yours, and cull through the articles to obtain useful tips. The main tip you will pick up is that if you want your house to look really nice, you do not necessarily have to have professional training or even a special flair for design. All you need is more money than the human mind can comprehend. You will learn this from 8-page color photo spreads featuring homes the size of Baltimore, always called villas, situated on dramatic mountainside real estate, accessible to ordinary citizens such as yourself only by telescope. The accompanying articles sound like this. The owners, he, a prominent industrial neurosurgeon, and president of four major investment firms, she, a best-selling novelist and queen of Belgium, knew exactly what they wanted when they decided to build the Villa de Muchos Simulions. We wanted, they said in unison, the kind of informal and inviting home where we could entertain our friends and, if we felt like it, play polo in the foyer. Their design consultants, Wilmington A. Bill Sashwaite IV and Marjorie Pookie Westinghouse Armature, sought to create a fun motif by decorating the ceilings in the master bath with frescoes done originally for the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo, and importing a working Hawaiian volcano to heat the pool, which was originally a lake in Switzerland. For the owner's two children, originally the children of a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and a world-renowned ballet dancer, who sleep in their own wing, originally Versailles, the designers chose, and so on and so on. After you have read a few articles like this, you should have plenty of nifty ideas for the kind of furniture you want, although, of course, given your price range, you will have to buy it at a store with a name like Big Stu's Discount House of Taste, where the dinette seats are made from compressed oatmeal. Besides money, the other thing you need is time. Nobody has ever come up with a good explanation as to why this is, but it takes longer to obtain a piece of furniture than to construct a suspension bridge. My theory is that furniture is not actually built by human beings, but is rather grown, probably in some intensely humid third world nation where they have giant furniture trees that can take years to produce a single ottoman. When you place your order for, let's say, a teal love seat, the order is mailed via boat to a furniture plantation, where a worker, who speaks little English, frowns at it, wipes the sweat from his brow, straps on his machete, and walks into the jungle. He halts briefly as a ripe armoire thuds into the earth ahead of him. Then he continues along the narrow path, squinting upward into the dense mass of vegetation overhead. He spots a dark shape far above him in the gloom. It could be a love seat in the early stages of formation, or it could be a coffee table, or a bark lounger, or a gorilla nest. Who knows, the worker thinks to himself, and what the hell is teal? So we're talking about a slow and inexact process, with one piece arriving years after another, which is why most people go through their entire lives without having all their furniture look nice at the same time. My advice is, order your furniture now, even if you don't even own a house yet, even if you are, in fact, an unborn child. Because if you're lucky, the last piece will arrive just in time for your great-great-grandchildren to spill Zuroni on it. Not that you will care. You'll hate it anyway. This is because of Newton's first law of furniture buying. The amount you will hate a given piece of furniture is equal to its cost multiplied by the length of time in months it takes to arrive. I recall the time my wife, Beth, finally got fed up with the brown sofa we had for many years, which looked like a buffalo that had staggered into our living room and died from a horrible skin disease. So she decided, the hell with our son's college education, she was going to get a new sectional sofa. She took many measurements. Then she went to many, many furniture stores. Then she ordered the sofa. Then we waited through several presidential administrations for it to arrive. And finally it did, and it was exactly what she had ordered, and so naturally it made her almost physically ill to look at it. I told her it looked fine to me, but it was no use. When she was looking at this sofa, she was looking at Jabba the Hutt. She would lie awake in bed at night, thinking about this huge thing squatting out there in her living room, and it was only a matter of time before she went insane and attacked it with a steak knife. So I was very relieved when she decided to sell it through a classified ad, which was a pretty interesting experience in itself. Eventually, she sold the sofa, and it wasn't such a bad experience after all, although it probably would have been easier and more relaxing if we had just gone out into the backyard and set fire to a small pile of $100 bills. Of course, there is a way to obtain nice furniture without the frustration and high cost of buying it new, provided you are willing to put in a few hours of honest elbow grease and possibly suffer permanent disfigurement. I am referring, of course, to the time-honored thrifty homeowner art of refinishing furniture. No doubt you have at one time or another visited the home of people who have a number of nice older wooden pieces, and you've said something complimentary, and your host said something like, "Oh, thanks. We bought them all for a total of $147.50 at garage sales and refinished them ourselves in the garage, and now they are worth, we conservatively estimate, $9 million. They are lying, of course. They stole all this stuff from the Museum of Nice Old Wood Furniture. Nevertheless, it is inevitable that at some point you will get the notion that you can have nice furniture via the refinishing method. So you might as well know the correct procedure. Number one, you go to a garage sale and you find a bureau covered with hideously ugly orange paint. Number two, you call your spouse over. And you say in a quiet voice, so the garage sale person can't overhear you, "Look at this. You know what this is under this paint? This is," choose one, "solid oak, solid bird's eye maple, solid walnut, solid oak and maple eye of walnut." It makes no difference what fine hardwood you claim the bureau is made of, because it will forever remain an elusive dream that you never actually lay eyes on, similar to the Lost Dutchman's mine. Number three, your spouse, shocked, whispers, "Whoever would be so foolish as to cover up such beautiful wood with paint? With a minimum of effort, this could be a lovely piece." Number four, feeling like thieves in the night, you pay $25 for the bureau and scuttle off with it. You do not hear the cynical laughter of the former owner. Number five, you go to the hardware store and purchase some steel wool and some refinishing product with a name like Cano Poison that has skeleton heads all over it, and a prominent consumer advisory like this: "Warning, do not let this product come in contact with your skin. Do not breathe the fumes. Do not have children after using this product. Do not buy this product. Do not even read this warning." Number six, you go home, put on some rubber gloves, and start scrubbing the paint with the toxic substance. It is hard work. It is dirty work. The gloves dissolve quickly, and it is clear that large patches of your skin will have to be surgically replaced. But it's all worth it, because after just a few hours, you have scraped away a small patch of that hideous orange paint, and underneath it you find a layer of hideous green paint. Number seven, you repeat this process for two, maybe even three more layers of paint. And finally, the truth dawns on you. This is not really a bureau. This has an enormous bureau-shaped wad of paint. Number eight, you decide to hold a garage sale. Next, Irma Bombeck tries her hand with household plants in Boston Fern, written November 13, 1986, and found in her book, Forever Irma. I bought a Boston fern last week, and as I placed it on the countertop, a hush came over the entire family. They were all remembering the one I brought home in 1981. Finally, my mother whispered to my husband, "I tried to talk her out of it, but you can't tell her anything." He said, "I hope you're not going to get emotionally involved with this one." One of my children shivered and said, "Is Ma going to be sick again?" I assured him that this Boston fern was different in many ways. The one I bought in 1981 cost $45, an excessive amount for a plant that cost more than my first set of flatware. I was an emotional pygmy then and never considered it would die in 3 days. Relationships with the flora and the fauna were important to me 5 years ago, and I felt personally responsible for their demise. I've watched PBS, and I'm wiser now. I know now that you can't take a Boston fern seriously. It'll tear your heart out. You have to know that from the moment you take it out of the nursery, it turns hostile. It doesn't want your water. It doesn't want your sun. It doesn't want your fertilizer or your Willie Nelson records. It just wants to die. So why do people buy Boston ferns in the first place? Because they need to feel challenged. You reach a stage in your life where you know you're not going to be Miss America. You're not going to win the Pillsbury Bake Off. Winning the lottery is a long shot, and you've been passed over too often to have a late night talk show of your own. so you see how long you can sustain a Boston fern. The fern was in the house 3 hours when it went limp. We all gathered around and offered advice. It's too near the stove. It's getting a draft from the air vent. You overwatered it. You should have misted it. It needs fertilizer. You should have gotten a heat lamp. The dust is killing it. Within 2 days, the fern was in the final stages of deterioration. I bit my lip and said, these things happen. Then I threw myself on the plant and gave it leaf-to-mouth resuscitation. The family restrained me. How much did you pay for it? Asked my husband. When will any of them ever understand that it isn't the money? A few days ago, I was going by one of those silk plant stores. I couldn't resist going in and checking on the fake Boston ferns. There were only two. Both of them had leaves missing, and the edges were turning brown. I felt better. And finally, Irma Beck tries to understand repairman ease, written March 3, 1988. We had a malfunction recently in our alarm, and they sent a man to check it out. When I asked him what the problem was, he said, one of the little wires is sick. Call it a gut feeling. But I felt he was talking down to me, so I said, could you put it a little more technically than that? He said, we were getting a silent signal when your toggle switch was inadvertently moved to the program position, so I reset it and checked to see whether there were any problem zones from the protective circuit due to winds the other night. I said, does that mean the boo-boo is gone and the sick wire will smile now? He nodded. For years, I've been trying to speak repairmanese, but the natives all sound like they have mouths full of Novocaine. Besides, the language has 56 known dialects: electrical, plumbing, refrigeration, termite control, roofing and siding, painting, washer repair. You haven't lived until you've tried to speak washer repair. All I wanted to know were a few well-placed phrases to repeat to my husband in order to justify a bill for $67.33. That's all I needed to know. By the time the washer repairman got finished with a 10-minute explanation, the only words I recognized were pump and boxer shorts. And by the time I translated it to my husband, he said, I don't understand why the pump was wearing my underwear. When we were building the house, it was like visiting the Tower of Babel. Everyone was speaking his own language at the same time. I remember saying something to the electricians about splicing a lot of wires together so two switches could have their hearts beat as one. They laughed for a week. As the alarm system repairman prepared to leave, I said, I understand why you weren't too technical. My job is the same way. I'm a writer. And if I told you my creative level was stagnating and the cadences and insights were eluding me, you wouldn't know what I was talking about either. He said, it means you don't have an idea for a column. The man is obviously bilingual. That's all we have time for today. Join me next month for That's a Laugh. I'm Sharon Silcox with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website at trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.